Hello and welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. The focus of today's episode is on fraud and corruption. It's no secret that the pandemic has been rife with opportunities for fraudsters to attempt to line their pockets from the public purse. And we'll be reflecting on this issue today with Neil Green, the Deputy Director for Counter-Fraud and Investigation at the Government Internal Audit Agency. We're also joined by Claire Quentin from King's College London. Claire is a research associate to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Corruption and Responsible Tax, which is chaired by Dame Margaret Hodge. They were recently involved in the publication of a new report targeting the enablers of tax avoidance. But before we go into that, over to Neil.
I am Alison Kroll, and I'm here with Neil Green. He is the Deputy Director of Counter-Fraud and Investigation at the Government Internal Audit Agency. Thank you for joining us, Neil.
Hi, Alison.
Could we get started by you just telling us a bit about your role at the Government Internal Audit Agency and what your team does?
Yeah, sure, of course. So the Government Internal Audit Agency, as the title says, we're predominantly an audit function. So we cover majority of government. I think it's around 13 central government departments at the latest count. It was part of a machinery of government change about 4 or 5 years ago now, which was bringing the audit function together and the audit profession into more single line service. But about 4 years ago, in 2016, we also created a counter-fraud and investigation function. That was part of an early journey that my team were on in trying to up the standards in how counter-fraud was being tackled across government, and also try to focus in and get some greater consistency in how government responds to counter-fraud. So it seemed a really opportune moment to create a counter-fraud and investigation team within the Government Internal Audit Agency, which is what we did. So I lead that team. As I say, we've been there for about 4 years, and we've served, probably at latest count, we're approaching 80 different organisations across government. So it's been a phenomenal 4 years, and it just shows just the amount of work needed to improve the counter-fraud response across the public sector.
Great, thanks. So let's get started with the first question. You've recently spoken at our annual conference, Public Finance Live, about fraud trends in UK government. Could you outline what you think some of the biggest problems are that the public sector is facing as a result of COVID-19?
Yeah, of course. I think I'd start by talking about, as we're all very aware, just the impact and sheer pace of response and the scale of the response that government had to put in place in response to this pandemic. You know, the real focus on helping people, businesses and the economy to continue to survive, massive challenges. So with that absolute pace and scale of response and the massive stimulus packages that government put into place, it's really presented some real challenges in managing the risk of fraud. It's fair to say, you know, we knew going into this fraud would happen. There's no way you introduce such massive programs so quickly and can prevent fraud. It's just not doable. But there was very little we could do in the time frame to fully mitigate the risk, as both central and local government, the primary objectives were quite right. It was about getting money out to those who needed it most. And in doing that, we provided some opportunities for the less honest in communities and some of those criminal gangs out there. And we're already seeing quite a number actually of fraud cases emerging, so we shouldn't be surprised by that. That in itself is a challenge for us, but one perhaps we expected and we now just need to deal with. And when I spoke, I think it was back in June, we did, or SIPFA ran, a fraud implications of COVID webinar, and I was explaining back then in June how existing frauds were already starting to come through in the system, but also that ongoing challenge for government, both central and local government, in terms of existing frauds, because COVID has been an absolute distraction, and understandably so, and it does predominate all of the sort of media coverage, and again, that is understandable. But of course, business continues and the more routine frauds continue. I think that's one of the things that probably concerns me as we continue now. Clearly, we're into, as we talk today in October, we're talking about different tiers of lockdown across the whole of the UK. And again, certainly in GIA and many parts of government, there's the encouragement to work from home again for a more prolonged period. So all of that just brings lots and lots of challenges for us, both central and local government. I mean, it's just been phenomenal, I think, how people have reacted, how staff across central and local government have reacted and adapted to work during the pandemic. And we've embraced technology and all the rest of those things, but it has created greater risk as well. You know, we have seen a weakening in controls, and that is a challenge for us.
Okay, that leads into Our next question. An issue that has been in the spotlight lately is grant fraud. Could you say more about grant fraud, how it's impacting the sector, and what you expect to see in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, because as part of the stimulus spend, the stimulus funding, grants has been quite a significant part of that. And the very nature of grants has always made them a little more susceptible to fraud. The very fact that they tend to be discretionary awards, they don't require repayment, can make them a slightly easier target for fraud, as opposed, for example, to a loan, which has an upfront repayment arrangement normally agreed. And before COVID, we were already spending massive amounts of money on grants across government, particularly across local governments, and massive grant spending there. I think it accounted for something in the region of £140 billion a year, which is quite a considerable, probably our fifth of overall government expenditure. And furthermore, you know, even before COVID, we were estimating that government was losing anything between 20 and approaching £50 billion a year to fraud and error overall. So you then introduced the COVID-19 and clearly mass grants and stimulus packages, and that whole risk has risen significantly, it's fair to say. We've already investigated a number of grant frauds, and the sort of areas we've seen would be student financing, property improvement, things to do with the environment, so environment regeneration schemes. But key features, I guess, that we've seen repeat themselves over and over, or features of some of these issues, has been a slow response when concerns are raised. And we could talk at length about that in terms of whistleblowing and how organisations respond. But often it's a slow response. It's not as fast as we would like. Too much conversation about, you know, what do we do about this concern, this issue. So a slow response when concerns are raised. A lack of due diligence up front. More due diligence. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but often where we see a problem, it looks quite obvious to people who then look at it with the benefit of hindsight that more due diligence could have been done and could have perhaps prevented the issue or the fraud. And poor information or intelligence sharing. So again, fraudsters don't, particularly organised fraudsters, they don't just attack one part of central or local government or one local authority. The fraudsters have been very professional in how they've tried to attack and maximise their gain. So that poor intelligence sharing can be a feature there, where we're not sharing information well enough. And that's something we can level up both central and local government. We don't join up as well as we could do to assist some of that due diligence, information sharing, and help, if not prevent, at least deter by having those better front-end controls in place. So I think it's fair to say, you know, this is a high-risk area. I think we'll see many more grant frauds as we go forward, particularly with the background of COVID.
So this summer, government released a toolkit to help practitioners fight fraud in the public sector. Could you describe the tool and how it's helping local authorities prevent and detect fraud?
Yeah, so this was the post-event assurance toolkit. It was something that we developed probably about 2 months into the start of the pandemic response. So yeah, I think it was June, July, it was finally issued. So it's a toolkit that brings together a number of other tools. So it doesn't reinvent the wheel. The idea of the toolkit is to bring together a wide range of existing tools, but put them or signpost them in one place, so that in a sort of single way, organisations in local authorities and also for central government departments and agencies as well, can just help have a more systematic identification and approach to identifying loss or non-compliance or irregularity through those post-payment checks. So there's a wide range of tools within the post-event assurance toolkit. And there's one that many may have heard of called Spotlight. Again, it brings together open source data, but it does it in a single way. And there are various other ones within the toolkit, Experian checks, and there's a long list. But it's been a really useful toolkit to help organisations across the public sector just to understand what's out there. I think that's often the difficulty when you're trying to do these types of things, is you only know what you know, and perhaps that's limited to what your organisation knows. So this has been a great opportunity to pull all of that information and those tools into one place. I guess I could probably say a little bit more from a central government perspective, because we work quite closely with MHTLG, Housing, Communities and Local Government. And I know I think their Section 31 grants paid to local authorities. There is a need for local authorities to take responsibility for appropriate assurance testing and recovery of irregularities, fraud, error, etc. So I know to support that agenda, MHCLG has been working with CIPFA and local authorities, I believe, to support that whole response. So I believe there's a new group. I don't immediately know too much about it, but that group will be an important part of the knowledge sharing and the communication efforts, really just to help that counter fraud activity and response during and beyond COVID. So some of the features that I believe are in it is just bringing expertise together, having better access to specialist resources, better coordination across organisations and departments and various things like that. So yeah, the post-event assurance toolkit is a great thing to signpost organisations in their post-event assurance agenda and action planning. And yeah, I believe CIPFA, MHCLG and local authorities are also working together to further that whole agenda.
Interesting. Thank you. What else do you think public finance professionals should consider, and what actions can they take as the pandemic continues?
So I think it's continue to be flexible and agile. I think be on the front foot and be very alive to the risks. One of the key things we've been talking about in the agency, we're looking now to the second 6 months, because as I said at the start, you know, we're now into sort of different tiers of lockdown across the country. And therefore that working from home, for example, will be for a more extended period of time for many people across central and local government. And one of the things that probably worries me a little is that whilst we, as I said earlier, just had a phenomenal response to how we've adapted to the way that we work and have continued to deliver in very testing circumstances, just within my team, I know some of those challenges, including, you know, caring responsibilities, balancing homeschooling, you know, and the various other things that the people have had to juggle and balance during this pandemic so far. What we have done, which is brilliant, is we've adapted those ways of working. We've had revised ways of working to ensure we can continue to deliver. And we may have been far more flexible than we had been before. But I guess my message would be just don't naively or be aware of the risk of naivety in assuming that those revised ways of working haven't created some problems for the future, just because no red flags have yet gone up. And I guess it's things, practical things, such as if you've given higher levels of security access or systems access, you know, do you have clear processes in place to review those and reduce them back down at the best appropriate time? Have you been considering the wider security implications? You know, things such as printing from home. It's one of those things that is an absolute no-no, but has that, you know, if people haven't been able to print and need to print things, how are you getting around that? And has that in itself raised other risks and security concerns? Do you know how people are securing information and data whilst they are working from home? So I think that there are some things we're starting to see. For example, you know, leaking of information. People working from home, we don't have the physical security of working in an office with colleagues. Working from home, you're a little bit more removed, of course, from colleagues. And therefore, that in itself changes the risk profile. So I guess I don't want to be the naysayer of, you know, clearly this is all bad, because it's not. It's brilliant what we've done, absolutely brilliant. But for senior leaders, if you've had to redeploy staff, if you've introduced new policies, any new initiatives, do think about them from a risk-based and a fraud risk-based position. And I guess for senior leaders also, maybe something about standing up and speaking truth unto power, as we would sometimes refer to. So what do I mean by that? We've really found that the pressures of COVID and having to deliver in a much different way and then introduce brand new initiatives in a very fast-paced environment has been added on to business as usual activities. And I sometimes think we maybe have not done enough to think or explore the art of the possible in respect of postponing some of those business as usual activities. So if there's a new non-COVID initiative, do we really need to launch it now? Or could we postpone it rather than trying to drive on relentlessly and deliver everything? Because when we try to do too much, that's when mistakes are made. And the consequences are not immediate. They're only really felt and understood at a future point, with the wonderful benefits of hindsight. But of course, that's too late. So I guess that's probably what I would say. And maybe a final note, just remember culture, because it's people, not processes, that take action. So making sure that, you know, people feel well supported, they understand and live by the clear values that you set, and ensuring that personnel and staff support and buy into those and live by those values.
Great, thank you. That was all really helpful and informative. Thank you so much for joining us today, Neil.
Not at all. Thank you.
Thanks again to Neil for joining us today. Up next is Claire Quentin, who joined us to speak about the APPG on Anti-Corruption and Responsible Tax's recent report into tax avoidance and legislative change to target those enabling criminal practices. I'm here with Claire Quentin from King's College London. Claire is a research associate to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Corruption and Responsible Tax. Really pleased you could be with us today. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to work with the Policy Institute?
So my background is I'm a tax barrister, and then I left practice to do a PhD, and this is a postdoctoral research role.
So Claire, could you tell me a bit more about the APPG? Obviously, it recently rebranded and slightly changed its focus. So what kind of work have you been doing with them, and how has that changed over time?
The focus was formerly on responsible tax. This is about responsible behaviour by taxpayers and also responsible tax policy making. But that spills over very significantly into anti-corruption work, because we've been dealing a lot with issues to do with the behaviour of tax havens and the behaviour of taxpayers in relation to tax havens. And so the group has recently merged with the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Anti-Corruption. So we're now this slightly unwieldy from the point of view of our name, because of the overlap between the two areas.
So you recently released a new report, and Margaret Hodge is the chair for the APPG. Now, in her foreword, she outlines that now more than ever, it's essential that we crack down on those that don't pay their fair share. It is absolutely the right time for us to be even tougher on aggressive tax avoidance wherever it occurs. So why now? Why is now the time to be addressing the issue?
I mean, it's always a good time to be addressing the issue of antisocial tax behaviour. Obviously, you know, public finances are under great strain because of the COVID crisis, and it's more important than ever that people comply with tax laws so that public finances aren't under additional unnecessary strain.
So your report states that the way the law is currently set out means that it's virtually impossible to prosecute these enablers of failed tax avoidance schemes, even when a criminal offence has been committed. So as someone who doesn't come from a legal background, and a lot of our audience are finance professionals, could you talk us through the barriers that exist to prosecuting criminal offences in this area?
So a key point to make from the outset is that this isn't about a sort of general difficulty in prosecuting tax evasion and tax fraud. There are laws out there that criminalise tax evasion, tax fraud, and HMRC deploys them to prosecute that kind of behaviour. This is about a slightly different problem. This is about a situation where people enter into tax avoidance schemes which claim to be lawful. So the tax avoidance scheme will be promoted by an advisor, maybe backed up by a lawyer's opinion. The claim will be that if you arrange your affairs in a certain way, you legally don't have to pay the tax that you otherwise would have to pay. Now, sometimes these schemes work and sometimes they don't. And what we're concentrating on in this paper, in our policy paper, is situations where the scheme doesn't work and it's such an aggressive scheme that it should have been completely obvious to the advisor and the lawyer that it was a scheme that doesn't work. In these cases, it's perfectly reasonable to suppose that the advisor knew perfectly well the scheme wasn't going to work. And so when they advised that it was going to work, their advice was dishonest because they knew it wasn't going to work. And the reason they advised that it does work is because it gives the client an opportunity to try and not pay tax that actually they legally have to pay. But because the advice is dishonest, the advisor knows the scheme doesn't work. That means that the dishonesty element in the criminal offence of cheating the public revenue is there. So this should be prosecuted as a crime, but actually it's treated as just ordinary failed tax avoidance. And the reason that HMRC can't go after this stuff, even though it's a criminal offence, is because it's very hard to prove that someone knew they were giving bad advice. Because what they're going to do if you prosecute them is they're going to say, oh, well, I honestly thought this scheme would work. You know, that was just my honest professional opinion, even though 99 tax advisors out of 100 would say there's no way in a million years this scheme would work. It's completely bananas. So HMRC don't prosecute this stuff as criminal tax fraud. When they encounter this stuff, they pursue the tax as if it's ordinary tax avoidance, and if they get it, so much the better for the public exchequer. But the people who've committed the crime sort of carry on to flog these things another day.
But isn't this already dealt with under the law?
The thing is, there already is on the statute books some legislation which targets this precise situation, and that's the double reasonableness test in the general anti-abuse rule. That test performs precisely the same task that the dishonesty element in the criminal offence performs, in the sense that it doesn't bite just where the advice is wrong. It only bites where the advice is so wrong that it's not plausible that anyone could think that it was right. So we've got the legislation on the statute book to weed out this sort of situation. It's just not being used for these purposes. So the intervention we're proposing is that where the double reasonableness test, general anti-abuse rule, is satisfied, then HMRC can use satisfaction of that test instead of having to show dishonesty in a prosecution for cheating the public revenue. So they still have to make out all the other elements of the cheating the public revenue offence. It's just that they don't come unstuck at this point where they say, oh, well, you can't possibly have meant that advice. You know it was false. And the advisor says, well, no, I genuinely believed it. They don't have to get over that hurdle because the general anti-abuse rule double reasonableness test has done that job for them. So, and the idea here isn't to suddenly criminalise the entirety of the tax industry. That's not what this is about. This is so that when a tax advisor gets called by a scheme promoter and the scheme promoter says, we've got this great new scheme, you know, do you think it's a runner? The tax advisor, instead of thinking, well, if I say yes, they'll pay me tens of thousands of pounds, that's great. Instead of thinking that, they'll say, well, if I say yes, even though I can see this thing doesn't work, then I'm going to get prosecuted. So I'm just going to say the truth, which is no, I'm sorry, this scheme doesn't work. So that's the idea of our intervention. When you drill down to the details of our discussion paper, our policy paper, it's actually quite a narrow, targeted thing. The point is it's about filling a gap in the existing rules. It's about making it possible to prosecute criminal offences that are already taking place. And people might read this paper and think, well, I'm a bit worried about that. It sounds like I'm introducing the criminal law where it doesn't belong. You know, tax avoidance is legal and tax evasion is illegal, and the criminal law shouldn't be crossing this boundary. Well, what we're doing is saying, no, the criminal law is already relevant in these cases. It's just there are practical impediments to bringing it to bear, and it's those practical impediments that we want to get over.
Okay, so the publication has been put out into the world. What's the kind of engagement from parliamentarians and stakeholders been like, and what are kind of the next steps for lobbying for these kind of legislative changes?
As you can imagine, it attracted a certain amount of negative attention from the tax industry, but that's only to be expected because it's a fairly conservative industry and a fairly lucrative one. So they don't like proposals that constrain their ability to do the things they do. So next steps are we have a seminar where we're going to present this paper, and that's going to take place on 12th of November at 11 a.m. And there'll be a representative from the tax industry, and there'll be a minister, and there'll be a representative from the tax justice campaigning sector. So we think we'll have a really good conversation, and I'd invite anyone listening to this podcast to join in.
Excellent, and we'll have details about that in the description below. Following on from that, is there anything else that's coming down the pipeline in terms of your research with the APPG?
Quite a lot of stuff. Because of the merger of the APPG, we're in between websites currently, so I can't direct your listeners, sadly, to a nice sort of schedule of what we've got going on. But in due course, our new website, the website for the merged combined APPG on anti-corruption and responsible tax, will be up. I'd urge your listeners to go and check it out and see what we're up to.
Excellent. Well, I think that's about all we've got time for. So thank you very much for your time today, Claire.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Sip the Speaks, and that was Claire Quentin from King's College London. That about wraps it up for this episode. Thank you to all of our guests for joining us, and we will see you again next time.